Good afternoon. Welcome to the Transportation Committee. There is a quorum present, and first item on the agenda is approval of the minutes for March 5th, 2025. Vice Chair Myers, have you had a chance to review the minutes and move to approve them?
I have, Mr. Chair. I move the minutes.
The minutes have been moved by Vice Chair Myers. Any questions to the minutes? All those in favor of approving the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. Minutes are approved. A couple, two bills today, but first we're going to start off with the presentation from Minnesota Department of Transportation on a report, an important report that I think is critical to understand and recognize. And that is the road funding gap report that MnDOT is required to provide to us. But it provides us a good context, members, of where we're at in funding our transportation needs and maintaining our infrastructure. And so Mr. Josh Cantenrude Hubinger, I know I can shorten it up, but I think I'm getting pretty good at saying it. Appreciate the department's willingness to present to us today for a bit, and members, we will have some discussion after it if you have some questions. So we'll go through the presentation, and if you have some questions, we'll entertain them at the end. And I, as far as the couple of testifiers on other bills are waiting to get in on the Zoom link, is that right?
There's one person.
Okay. But there we go on the screen. We have our presentation. And so welcome to the committee. Appreciate you spending making time for us today. And if you know the drill, please state your name and who you're with for the record, and then just go ahead and proceed with the with your presentation. And then if you can stick around for some questions, that'd be fantastic.
Sounds good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, for the record, my name is Josh Knadert Hubinger. KH is just fine in the interest of time. Going forward, I'm the CFO at MnDOT here to give a brief update on the road funding gap report that was legislatively required and published a couple months ago. So the language is on the screen. This is all of the requirements as part of this report due back in November, but basically required MnDOT to look at the funding that currently flows through the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, the main source of revenue for transportation in the state of Minnesota. Look at the next 10 years, so in this case, 2025 through 2034, and identify what needs existed on that system, how much money was anticipated with current revenues, what that gap was, and then options to close the gap. And there are a variety of requirements on those options to consider, which are at the bottom of this screen, things like social equity, financial stability, convenience, efficiency, et cetera, which I will get into a little more. So just to kind of set the stage again, or a refresher, HUTD fund, the single biggest source of funding for transportation in the state of Minnesota, in state fiscal year 2024, totaled just under $3 billion, so about $2.7 billion flowed through this fund. Consists of three primary sources, the gas tax, the motor vehicle registration tax, the tabs you pay on your vehicle, and a 60% of the motor vehicle sales tax when you purchase a vehicle. Those three elements make up about 90% of the revenue in this fund. There's also a variety of smaller state sales taxes that either all or in part go to the HUTD fund. So things like rental taxes on vehicles, a portion of the lease tax on vehicles, and a small portion of the sales tax on auto parts. So again, in total, $2.7 billion. A couple things of note, in 24, registration taxes are actually the biggest revenue source for the system now. Overtook gas taxes for the first time. Motor vehicle sales tax, 60% of the total revenue goes to HUTD. The other 40% goes to transit. In total, that is the single biggest revenue source for transportation more broadly, and the third biggest source for the HUTD fund. So again, $2.7 billion. Per the Constitution, this is divvied up amongst the different systems for the state. So the Trunk Highway Fund gets 62% of 95% of the total. Counties get about a third, municipalities get about 10%. Just a little detail on each of those primary sources before we get into the report. Gas taxes, that part of the price you pay at the pump, This is actually paid by the distributors at the state level, so it's a very efficient tax currently. Costs about 0.25% to deliver this revenue source to transportation. It is 31.8 cents right now. It actually did just increase on January 1st for the first time in 10 plus years. It's now indexed to inflation going forward under current law. So it increased 3.3 cents on January 1st, which is tied to the inflation from MnDOT's construction cost index from 2022. So there's kind of a two-year look back for those increases. So it went up 3.3 cents based on the 13% inflation that MnDOT experienced back in 2022. Going forward, it'll look 1 year further. So this upcoming year, it'll look back to 23 and so on. The one caveat going forward is it's capped at no more than 3%. So it's projected to go up less than a penny each of the next 4 years. There's also a debt surcharge component to the gas tax that's dedicated to repaying debt from 2008. So there's about $2 billion in bonds passed back then, focused on bridges. Once those bonds are repaid, that surcharge will actually go away over the next 15 years or so when that's projected to happen. But again, some moving pieces in the gas tax. It is currently 31.8 cents. That puts us about 20th overall in terms of other states, 20th highest for the gas tax on its own. Registration taxes, there's a variety of components that go into what you actually pay. So it's 1.575% of the sticker price, essentially. In year one, it's based on 100% of that sticker price, and then it goes down a certain percentage each year over 10 years, and then in year 11 and beyond, you just pay a fixed $30. So it's pretty high in year one, works its way down to $30 in year 11. On average, it's about $150 per vehicle. And then motor vehicle sales tax, this is a percentage, the same as the state general sales tax rate, 6.875%. It's on both new and used vehicles. And again, 60% goes to HUTD, 40% goes to transit, which is shared between the Met Council for the Twin Cities Metro Area Transit and MnDOT for Greater Minnesota Transit. So kind of working into the gap, a big piece of this is inflation. So the chart on the screen, the blue bars are the nominal increases for HUTD revenues looking back to 1980. You see a variety of increases over that time. Gas tax increases, the big funding package after the 35W bridge collapse in 2007, some general fund transfers starting in 2018 that were pretty significant, and then the variety of changes in 2023. So in terms of nominal dollars, the revenue source has grown quite a bit over the last 50 years, about 5% a year, but then when you adjust for inflation, it's more like 1%. And that's the red line kind of cutting through in the middle there. So getting into the gap. So process for this report, we do have a 20-year plan for MnDOT for the trunk highway system that does exactly that already. It's something that's updated every 5 years, and it looks at, based on our performance measures and our variety of desired outcomes by program, how much money do we think we need to meet those goals over the next 20 years? How much money do we think we'll have over that same time period? The first version of this report came out in 2013. Identified about a $12 billion gap over 20 years, so about $600 million a year. The subsequent update in 2017, that number got bigger, about $900 million a year. And then the 2023 report, before all of the changes in the 23 session, went up again, about $1.15 billion a year. Again, these are numbers just for the trunk highway portion of HUTD, so the MnDOT portion of HUTD. The variety of changes in 2023 took a big bite out of that funding gap, estimated to cover about $5 billion of that about $23 billion gap. So about 20% of the gap was closed with all those new revenues. And so after that, the remaining gap is about $890 million. That's the starting point for this report. So taking that same number, $890 million a year over the next 20 years, assumed it's pretty consistent over the next 10 years and then years 10 through 20. So started with that number, cut it in half, and then assumed, so this is a big assumption, that the needs on the county and city systems were comparable, and so just essentially backed into the needs numbers for counties and cities. And so the table in the corner summarizes the math, but again, trunk highway system, about $1.1 billion a year in additional needs, counties about $600 million. city's about $200 million, add it all up together for the HUTD fund, that's about a $1.9 billion gap on top of existing revenues. So would need about 80% more money than we currently get to cover all of the needs. And then the meat of the report basically looked at a variety of options to help close the gap, kind of tiered into three different categories. There's statewide options or system-wide options, so things like increasing the gas tax, increasing registration taxes, working towards a road user charge or RUC, so that's a mileage-based fee that has been considered and implemented in a couple states so far. Some more local options, things like the county wheelage tax, local option sales taxes, and then some more kind of program and project-specific options, things like expanding EasyPass, kind of alternative financing sources like TIFIA, that's a federal loan program, et cetera. And then for each one of those options, gave a little background, identified that kind of order of magnitude, revenue raising capacity, that tax burden, and then those other factors, things like how efficient would it be, how easy would it be to deliver, transparency, the variety of options or things required in the report. Again, for today, keeping it very high level, happy to talk about any specific recommendation. But in the end, the report basically identified those 22 options and determined that the way to close the gap, it's kind of it'll take a village, a variety of those options combined together is likely the best approach to help close that gap and continue to deliver on what Minnesotans need. The other side of this equation always is how well are we doing with what we get? And so just wanted to close with a couple metrics before I open it up for questions. So we're actually doing very well as a state right now in terms of our pavement and bridge condition compared to our targets. And this is percentage of the system that is considered poor based on our definitions. So for pavement on all three components of the trunk highway system, we're actually meeting our performance measures but for interstate, national highway system, and non-NHS. On the bridge side, not quite meeting our target on NHS. A large part of that is the Blatnick Bridge, which will get addressed in a couple years here. But again, overall, for both pavement and bridge, which is 80% of our assets, they're actually in very good shape right now. The issue is they're projected to deteriorate faster than revenues will keep up. And so longer term, there's still a gap, but we are doing quite well currently. And then the other thing I just wanted to briefly mention, there has been a requirement since 2018 for MnDOT to identify efficiencies, so savings on projects or on the admin or ops and maintenance side. There's actual number spelled out in legislation saying we have to identify at least 15% of all the new money we get starting in 2018. And so over the last 7 years, that number would be about $350 million. We, in our reports, have identified about double that so far. So far we're meeting that requirement and then some. And those savings just get thrown back into the system. So it just means more money for more projects. It's not specifically carved out for anything, any specific program. But that is all I had. Happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Kind of gives us a baseline. Sometimes members, I'd encourage you to go back through it if you have some more questions. We'll start with Representative Sensenmuir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the report, and apologies for coming in a little late. So I don't know if this is addressed at the beginning of the presentation, but I think a general question I have is, do we have too many roads in Minnesota? When I hear that we have like the fifth largest road system in the U.S., that doesn't make sense to me either in terms of population or size of our state. So is that something that you were thinking about when doing this report?
Mr. KH.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so that's a great question. Yes, we do have the fourth largest roadway system in the country currently. The other states at the top tend to be the obviously biggest landmass states like Texas, but Kansas is another state. Some of the rural farming states do have more roads than you would think given the population. There is always an effort to right-size the system. So even in the current funding model, on the bottom right of this flowchart, in that 5% set-aside, the flexible highway account is also known as the turnback account. It is a dedicated pot to be used to at least take the roadway system, get it in a good condition, and at least hand over jurisdiction to the right level of government. It doesn't explicitly get rid of any roadway miles, but it is one way to at least kind of right-size ownership. But to your point, there's always this question on could we do more with less? I think that is sometimes evaluated, but I would just say once a road is there, it's hard to get rid of it in general.
Thank you. We have a number of members that have questions, so if we can try to keep the questions concise and the answers, but we do want to dig into this, and I think it's important. Representative Scraba, did you have a quick question?
On impact of 23 legislation covered $5.2 billion of the gap. Where did that come from, and what revenues? You spoke about revenues. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so there's a variety of changes made in 2023. On the screen now, from the primary sources, the gas tax, that 3.3 cent inflation index was a big piece of it. So that's about $100 million a year over 20 years. That gets you a lot of that. The registration tax, the entire structure was changed. So that rate went up from about 1.3% to closer to 1.6%. So the rate was higher, and then that depreciation schedule was also slowed down. So you pay more for longer. So those are the two big pieces. MVEST was increased slightly to match the general sales tax rate, so it used to be 6.5%. So all three of the kind of primary HUTD revenues were all changed in some way. And then there are some other smaller pieces as well.
Are you good? There is a excellent memo that Mr. Burris put out on the 23 legislation that we can forward to the committee members too. Did a good job of laying that out. Representative Scraba, did you have a follow-up or you're good?
Thank you, Chair. You had said that the state tax was 20th in the nation, gas tax. Where are tabs, our license tabs, compared in the nation?
Mr. Chair, Representative, so registration taxes are a little harder to pin down for the average because it's such a moving target, but very fair to say we have one of the higher registration taxes.
Okay.
Thank you.
We will go to Representative Tabke.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And my question is similar to what Representative Sensabria asked, but on the need side of things for what we're paying for at MnDOT Roads, what I don't know what the best way to ask, but like, what percentage do you think of that need dollars that we have are maintaining current roads? What are any expansion side of things, and what are safety projects? Like, how does that kind of break down into what buckets?
Mr. Chair, Representative, so there's a lot of great detail in that same 20-year MnSHIP that has there's some simple summary charts that do a good job of answering exactly that question. High level, I want to say about 70% of the needs is maintaining what we have. Less than 5% is for expansion, and then safety is a significant component of what's left, and then about 20% is needed just to deliver on the rest of it. So 70% of that total is maintaining what we have.
A good question. Follow-up? Representative Jones?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Cage. I have a question about on slide 11. You had mentioned some good things about some efficiencies that you found, actually more than what was mandated. Can you give us some detail about what efficiencies? Can you give some examples?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative. So again, there is a annual legislative report, in this case, Major Highway Projects Report, that itemizes every one of those efficiencies. And so that report for 24 just came out in the last few weeks. Broadly speaking, as you can see from the splits, it's mostly savings specific to projects. So it's things like value engineering or kind of changing the footprint of a project to save money on the original plans. But it does go through and break down each individual component there too.
Representative Jones, do you have a follow-up? Because I'm very interested in your question.
I have a follow-up, but it's actually to some of the other questions real quick. I just wanted to mention on this kind of a conversation around the size of our system. I think maybe some folks think like, oh, this is just an issue we need to be addressing in greater Minnesota, but I actually want to provide an example. In Minneapolis, in Milwaukee Avenue was a place where they actually took out two blocks of a road because there's still access from the alleys. And so that was able like to create some savings. So that's just an idea that we can pursue going forward.
Mr. Cantrude-Hubinger, so we've got the efficiency report, and it's, you know, it's something that I was told about when I was a freshman legislature, and I was like, well, what do you mean efficiency? Where does that come from? And I'm glad to see that that's being reported. Is that quantifiable efficiency amount that you have in the report, is that something that we can translate into dollars to put into other projects? There's been talk about possibly using that to fund our resiliency program. Can we transfer those dollars into another spendable pool of money and to actually materialize it into road construction or other needs?
So, Mr. Chair, the simple answer would be yes. The way we currently manage that process, it just means we have more money for other areas of the program. So it'd be indirectly. We don't like save money on one project and set that money aside for that exact same type of project. But we could certainly do something like identify the number from the efficiencies and then from the subsequent year, take that off the top for something specific that the legislature would want.
Excellent. Absolutely. That's something that I think the committee will be interested in. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. KH. So two questions. How is the gap actually calculated? And then is there such a thing as a transit funding gap report?
Mr. KH.
Mr. Chair, Representative. So great question. For the calculation, again, the Minship does a pretty decent job of explaining the logic. A lot of it is tied specifically to performance measures. So for pavement and bridge, we know how much each $1 million gets us. We know where we want the pavement condition to be, so it's basically a math problem. Some of the other areas are a little more nebulous. It's things like we want congestion to improve, so we need to make sure we dedicate some money to Easy Pass and some other kind of high cost benefit type things there. But it's kind of a combination of simple math problems for some of our bigger assets and then some anecdotal math, I guess I would say, for some of those other programs. To the question about transit, I can't think off the top of my head that there's a comparable report, but certainly happy to follow up.
And Representative Kraft, we probably have been lax, but we're not totally done. I anticipate that we will have a more of a transit day and dig into that in the future point with Lead Cagle and myself. Any other follow-up?
Mr. Chair, no, it is just interesting that our default is road funding gap report, but not transit funding gap report.
Well, the report was a result of a specific legislation on that, but it's important. You know, I learned something that, you know, 70% of that gap is just maintaining our roads. It's not expansion. It's not even safety. So I think that's important. Representative Cagle, are you on? Or
no.
Okay. Representative Murphy, then Representative Olson, and I think then we'll probably move on to the bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Cage. I have a question kind of following up on the maintenance question. So can you give us an idea where it's done? Is it fixing potholes? Is it bridges? Is it overlays? How would you divide out the maintenance side of it? And then I just have a quick follow-up question, too.
Mr. KH, what type of maintenance are we talking about?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative. So again, not to point to another report, but that Minship does lay out kind of the splits for bridge condition versus road condition. In general, there's a benefit to fixing it at the right time. So you fix it sooner, it lasts longer. But it is a variety. There's complete reconditions of a road. There's patching and potholes and everything in between. So it's kind of a combination of all of them. And we do a lot of work in our planning process to program projects that get us the most service life. But it's a mix of all of them. But happy to follow up with more details on the splits within that 70%.
Do you need a follow-up, Mr. Representative
just
Murphy?
Just a quick one. What, okay. Just ballpark. What do you think? Is it 25% roads, you know, or bridges? What would be a ballpark?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would believe it'd be maybe 60-40 roads to bridges, something in that neighborhood.
Okay, thank you. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for being here to explain this report to us. So I'm looking at the statute that was passed, and it says, the first thing it says, at a minimum, the report must analyze revenue options to address the funding gap over fiscal years, right? So that's one thing, but that's at a minimum. There seems to be half of this report that is missing in my mind, and that would be what can the department do to reduce costs? So when you're talking about a funding gap, you say half of it is maybe we can increase revenue. The other half is maybe we can reduce costs. Now, I really appreciate the fact that in your slide deck you have this conversation of efficiencies. But in my mind, and being around here just a little while, I would tend to question whether an organization says this project is going to cost us $600 million. Well, that's plus at 15% so we can meet requirements, and then we'll have approved $650 million, and then we'll just come out with this report that says we're meeting all of our efficiencies. And my hope was that through this we would see things like, you know, if we I had some MnDOT workers in my office, well, I don't have an office now, but we were having a conversation, and the conversation was, we really want to do the work. We don't want the DOT to contract out to other individuals. And they said, we want this work, and we can do it cheaper. And they even said, pay us more, and we'll still do it cheaper. And that seems like a significant cost savings by doing it that way. I just had a conversation a couple weeks ago about this, the cosmetics aspect of a project. And the department sent me that evaluation, and I found out that if you are in the top tier for a bridge, you could receive $3 million for the cosmetics of your bridge. Now, cosmetics of a bridge isn't keeping anyone safe. It's not getting you across the bridge better. But the state is paying up to $3 million so your bridge looks nice, right? That seems like something that could have been in this report listing what we can do to save money. I've been driving around the cities for a little while now. We've been here since January, and I can't see a single sound barrier wall that doesn't have all the paint peeled off of it. And this is treated wood that takes 18 months to dry out. And if you don't wait, it's good. The paint's going to peel. Why are we spending money on paint that's going to peel almost immediately? Now, the commissioner told me, well, you know, it's to save the wood. Well, it's not saving wood if it's peeled off, right? The same goes with galvanized steel. Why are we painting galvanized steel? The way it's built, it doesn't, unless you're priming it appropriately and doing a lot of work on it, the paint doesn't stick. So my hope is that we would have seen some significant lists of what the department can do if there's, and then the other part of the report's requirement was that you were supposed to propose legislative changes. Is there something that we as a state can do to alleviate the burden on you? You know, maybe the environmental standards that we're trying to mitigate, maybe that's going to be a huge significant cost. Can you provide us some instances where, you know, if we do our part, maybe you can do your part and cut some of that cost?
There was a lot there. Do you want to take a stab?
Mr. Chair, Representative, so yes, the report focused completely on one side of the equation, as laid out in the requirements, but completely fair, there's the other side of what are we doing with the money we have. And so that was the attempt with those kind of efficiency summaries and kind of payment condition. Here's how we're doing now. And we are doing fairly well for some of those measures. There's always more we can do, of course. So happy to provide more detail on some of those options on the kind of with current funding, what could we do less of, or what are barriers to be more efficient? Happy to follow up.
Yeah, that's a. Do you have a follow up?
I do. I'll rip it quick. Thank you. If you can get, like, I'm really interested in the things that we as legislators can do to alleviate the cost for the department. Okay, if it's just something that you guys can do internally, I highly recommend you do it. But if there's something that we are shackling you, let us free your bonds. And then the last question that I have, Mr. Chair, is we raised taxes and fees by about $10 billion in transportation the last 2 years, and the funding gap only reduced by $5 billion. That the math doesn't work. Where did it go? Did it vanish?
Mr. Chair, Representative, so the gap number, that $5 billion that got closed was just the trunk highway piece. So that's the 60% of the total going through HUTD. The other piece, to your point, there's a completely new, almost mini HUTD, Transportation Advancement Account, that's not part of this report, but is new money going to transportation from a new delivery fee and a couple other things. That's new revenue. That'll be $300 million a year once it's fully phased in 10 years from now. So that's almost outside of the scope of this report, but completely new revenue for transportation over the next 10 years. That was not part of this.
Mr. KH, on that funding gap amount, does that, so that included the new revenue and our getting behind on our maintenance and that stuff, does that gap, the new gap number, also include new mandates that were implemented in recent legislation?
Mr. Chair, so I think it'd be fair to say that part of what's driving that gap is how much doing existing work costs. So that's all of the different moving pieces for requirements and all the considerations. So fair to say yes.
So to clarify, it does include mitigation efforts on greenhouse gases and such in that gap?
And Mr. Chair, apologies. So a lot of the work related to the new laws that have passed are early stages, but I think it's fair to say there's a lot of requirements that go into these projects that mean one project is more expensive now than it was 10 or 20 years ago. Absolutely.
So I'm not hearing a complete yes there.
It's a muddy yes.
Thank you. Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. KH, I was going to try. But I was just wanted to clarify, too, that like the efficiency reports, that was something that was mandated in 2017. And so maybe that's something that we can go back and look at and see if we need to add something more to that. But I think one of the things that I've been hearing is that there's a report for that. There's a report for that. There's a report for that. And so one of the big pieces of legislation that I've been working on is a transparency piece. And so I think that's really something that would help when it comes to just going through all of these different reports and kind of centralizing information and making it more digestible and transparent. And so, you know, a lot of the things that were raised are bills that we do have. And I also want to talk a little bit about some of the mitigation efforts as well. You know, there's a bill that Representative Kraft has that would actually fund that mitigation effort. And so I'm really looking forward to when we can start hearing some of these bills that will really kind of impact and help help MnDOT when it comes to efficiencies and making sure that the funding is available. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cagle. I think those would be good discussions to be had. Mr. KH, thank you for your presentation and fielding some questions. I think it's important for us to kind of get a grasp of where we're at currently and where we need to be and how much it does cost to just maintain the infrastructure and systems that we have, because the dollars are large, but so, as was pointed out, so is our system, and maintaining that is not free, and it does come with a huge cost, but also you know, people are driving on our systems and using our systems. It's quite a responsibility to maintain it safely and efficiently for our taxpayers. So without any other questions, I appreciate your testimony and presentation today, and then we'll move on to Representative Joy's bill, House File 1242.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Joy, welcome back to the committee. Do you want to move your bill? And I believe, did you have an actual amendment, or you were discussed a small oral amendment?
Yeah, since this is being laid over.
We are laying this bill over, yes. So
to the bill, I motion that we move this bill.
We'll move House File 1242. Representative Joy moves House File 1242 to be laid over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee.
Yep. Go ahead and tell us what your bill does, and I think you'll have a couple testifiers. Thank you.
Sure. House File 1242 is before you today because trucking industry continues to face challenges finding and retaining high-quality commercial drivers. One of the specific impediments protective CDL holders facing is taking their driver's test in a predictable and timely manner. I've heard from constituents about this. Once this issue came to my attention, I then met with the Minnesota Truck Association and heard their concerns. Those conversations led to the common sense bill you see before you today. I have seen the letter from DVS, and while I understand their concerns, my objective is to ensure our state agencies are serving Minnesotans. I look forward to working with them to expand third-party testing. And then I have a couple testifiers today.
Thank you, Representative Joy. Do you want to just discuss what the oral amendment was, or clarification? Since we're just laying it over, we can just kind of clarify.
Yes.
We don't need a formal amendment.
Line 7.4 on the bill is changing that to say Commissioner of Transportation to Commissioner of Public Safety.
Correct. Mr. Burris, we just need to take note of it. There's no official action that we need to take. Is that correct? And that is just, the intent of that is just to have it be, reside within the correct department and the correct commissioner?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Joy. We have a testifier, Mr. John Hasladen, no stranger to the Transportation Committee. Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record, of course. Let us know who you're with, and love to hear your testimony.
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good to see you here today. At the outset, I would ask if the page could pass around a handout that has some draft recommendations from a joint MnDOT study. We'll put that right there. I'll be referring to that. It's a pleasure to be with you today on this sunny day. I am happy to testify in support of House File 1242. There's a statement we like to use in our industry, and that is, there's nothing without trucking. Every item of food, clothing, medicine, building materials, life-saving equipment, and raw ingredients travel by truck. And of course, every one of those trucks has a professional truck driver behind the wheel. Having an adequate number of trained and qualified drivers is the number one long-term issue facing the trucking industry. According to the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development, Minnesota currently faces a shortage of 3,925 truck drivers, and this mirrors a national shortage of just under 80,000 drivers. This shortage is made worse by a burdensome new federal entry-level driver training requirement and continued inefficiencies in the current state-controlled system of testing commercial driver applicants. House File 1242 helps address this shortage in two important ways. It expands the ability of existing third-party examiners to conduct more road tests, and it creates a new grant program to fund truck driver training and living expenses. First, House File 1242 expands testing capacity. The current state infrastructure for conducting written and road tests is simply not able to keep up with demand. We have reports of students completing CDL training programs, so they've gone through the whole training, and then having to wait several weeks or over a month to secure a testing slot. This is caused by a limited number of Department of Public Safety CDL road testing facilities around the state and the challenges that they have fully staffing the existing examiner positions. And here's the rub for a lot of trucking companies. When a testing facility is not available locally, instructors must think about this. When a Class D 16-year-old goes to get their license, they need a car. When you are a CDL tester, you can't drive it. You need to have a CDL holder to drive a truck, a trailer, and to chauffeur you to the location. So now imagine if that testing slot is more than 100 miles away. So even if a slot is open on a given day, that's a major hurdle. This then requires the instructor to chauffeur the student, like we said. And what it effectively does is it reduces instruction time that the instructor could be using, and an increased program costs. House File 1242 expands the ability of third-party testers to conduct road tests. And I want to stress, this is existing third-party testers. It does not expand who can do it. It allows them compensation for doing so, and it allows commercial driver training programs to schedule and reserve recurring testing times for commercial driver applicants, which is currently prohibited by law. Scheduling road testing slots will allow these programs to efficiently place students into testing slots just as they complete their training. And again, there's this gap we're talking about. If someone takes time, gets training, can't get the test, now what do we do? And we lose candidates in that process. Authorizing such scheduling will prioritize CDL exams within the existing system. And I think that's one of the things we'd like to stress, that when you're getting a CDL, that is your license to work, it is a part of the supply chain and the essential work in the economy, and if they have to wait for essentially Class D testers to slots to open up, that is a real challenge. Another thing, Senate House File 1242 creates a new grant program to foster the training of commercial truck drivers. This new funding source can be used to pay for tuition, living expenses, and reimburse fleets who conduct their own entry-level driver training program, which is allowed under the federal regulation. And training programs range from 4 weeks to 4 months. While grants for tuition, room and board, For four-year degrees are commonplace. Think about this. A lot of people in here who maybe got a four-year degree took out a loan, and that hamburger you bought first semester of your freshman year got financed for the whole time of that loan. But these programs for truck driver training are typically shorter. They're often not for credit. And so while you may be able to get tuition reimbursement or a scholarship for that, finding something to live on is incredibly challenging. So the innovative element of this bill is that it will make it far more likely that someone can transition mid-career knowing that they can support their family as they undergo training. And this living support is critical since the average age of a person seeking a commercial driver's license is 35, meaning they're likely to have a family, have a mortgage, and other expenses. So again, think of the dynamic when you're a CDL tester. Delayed road tests create significant financial hardships as the students wait to secure the CDL and then begin earning his income as a professional driver. And one of the things that makes truck driver programs different from others is that they have a very consistent, continual flow of students. Minnesota trucking companies, another piece of this, are eligible to provide this entry-level driver training, but face very real costs in delivering the training. A second innovative provision of this bill allows fleets to be reimbursed for direct costs up to providing training and creating a public-private partnership. It is including but not limited to the instructor salary, books, course materials, and really the most expensive thing is the vehicle maintenance, its operating costs, and its fuel and insurance. So the legislature recognized the significance of this issue, and just last year you directed the Minnesota Department of Public Safety and the Minnesota Department of Transportation to conduct a Minnesota Commercial Driver Workforce Study and jointly report their findings back to the legislature. I don't believe you have it in front of you yet, but the report will be coming to you shortly, and what you have passed around to you are the draft recommendations. Two of the draft recommendations from the study, and this group was from stakeholders, public, private, instructors, schools, students, fleets. This is what the people who have to use the system are recommending. They have two recommendations that support this. First, to continue to explore the expansion of third-party CDL testing, which is what we're doing in the first half. And secondly, to find ways to improve access to the affordability and feasibility of CDL training. And the second component does that. So we believe House File 1242 will make meaningful headway in reducing barriers that prevent successful recruitment and retention of professional truck drivers. And so we urge its passage. And we thank Representative Joy for bringing it forward. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for the testimony and explanation, kind of walkthrough of the bill. We have Representative Anderson and Olson. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for coming in. I just wanted to thank you for doing this. I have a large family, many, many siblings. Two of them are commercial truck drivers, two of my brothers. One of them is drives cars around, you know, from dealerships, and the other one actually works up in Prudhoe Bay in Alaska in that industry. And these are good jobs that are in many cases are mid-career, like you talked about in the case of both of my brothers, one of whom has a four-year degree that probably got some grants, you know, but nothing to get into this industry. So this is very, very needed. We have a huge need for more drivers across the state of Minnesota, and whatever we can do to get folks into those careers, you know, as easily as we can, I think is a good thing. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. And there is a letter from DVS, Driver and Vehicle Services Director. Shong, did you want to testify, or I think you were just sufficient with the letter? Okay, just want to double check. Is there any other public testimony I should have asked earlier? Well, there is one. Okay.
He's on the list.
I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead. I didn't see you on the list, but I'm going to let you provide testimony anyways. Welcome back, Mr. Benner. Please introduce yourself and who you're for the record, and then proceed with your testimony and keep it under 2 minutes.
I'll do my best, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Pat Benner. I'm a legislative representative with AFSCME Council 5. Thank you, Representative Joy and committee members, for hearing my testimony today. AFSCME Council 5 respectfully opposes House File 1242. We feel strongly that the privatization of government services will lead to more expensive outcomes for Minnesotans while sacrificing the integrity of the impartial process currently in place and increase the risk of bad actors committing fraudulent activity. We feel that the legislature has already done a lot to improve the state's capacity to get timely local road exams for both CDL and Class D licenses over the last few years, and there's no reason to abandon that progress right now. It is vital that our examiners remain impartial and don't have any conflict of interest when administering a road exam. Our roads, at least pre-COVID, were among the safest in the nation. Much of that is due to the enforcement of traffic laws in our state by law enforcement and a positive reputation for not-so-aggressive driving. But it's also because we have an impartial agency that administers license exams and doesn't award licenses to those that can't demonstrate an adequate level of proficiency. I want to reiterate some of the work that the legislature has done over the last few years because you should be commended for it. First and foremost, our biggest issue was not having the people to do the work. You changed that last session by appropriating new money to DVS with the blackout plate and increasing fees. And with that, DVS has been able to hire more testers and real progress has been made because of those decisions. We've made tremendous progress to the point of there are now thousands of available road exams over the next month for Class D and over 100 exams available for commercial driver's licenses across the state over the next month. There are some other issues, things that have driven the backlog of license exams that I think we could, as a, at the legislature, explore further because we need a more holistic discussion. For one, driver's education costs have skyrocketed in recent years. Driving schools, both public and private, have increased the prices by at least $50 over the last 3 years. I know because I checked in preparation of the last time I testified on this. In some cases, it's increased by over $100. We need to provide relief to students and their families so they can fully participate in behind-the-wheel instruction and be ready to pass their test within the first couple of tries. Sorry, one second. We need more metro capacity. We all know that, so let's work towards getting there. And we can finish it there. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Benner. Appreciate that. And then again, all members, there's the letter from DVS. So we are just laying this bill over. We have Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Housley, nice to see you again. A quick question for you on the first portion of the bill. Your issue seems to be availability of testers in a local, reasonably close to the person that wants to take the test. Is that correct? Versus it's a better way to do it in a private company versus doing it through the approach we do today. I mean, it seems like your issue is availability for a place that's reasonably close.
Mr. Hasladen.
Yeah, Representative Kraft, that would be, yes, it's throughput and capacity more than it is saying one is better than the other.
Follow up?
Yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. And so I appreciate that. And as we talk about this, I think that's key. I question whether diverting resources to two different areas is better than having more resources focused at one area. Generally, from an efficiency perspective, you'd be better off having more resources in one group than having a private group and a public group doing the same thing if you're talking about efficiency. So thank you.
Thank you for the comments. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is one of those regular instances where Representative Kraft and I disagree. I think that very rarely has the government ever been able to do something at a cheaper rate than the private sector. I think this is a wonderful opportunity to ensure that we have our trucks out on the road. You know, commercial truck drivers, that they're the lifeblood of our economy. If we don't have truckers on the road getting things from point one to point two or A to B or whichever way you're going, we're in significant trouble. And I think this addresses that issue very well. I think it's interesting that, you know, the first recommendation from the department is always additional funding for more testers. I think that's
kind of, they probably didn't even have to consider that one when they came up with it. And I do believe that, I do believe DVS when they say that they think it'll cost a little bit more resources in order to kind of cover down and audit any of the third-party testers. But I think that as a general rule, you have to hire X amount of testers or you hire one person to audit all the testers. I think that's going to come out in our favor in the end. But more than anything, so I've got a commercial driver's license. The United States Army trained me how to drive big trucks, and so I got one as a result of that. And I'm racking my brain trying to figure out how I would become a truck driver today, not owning one, not being able to show up for a road test with a truck that's going to pass the inspection because I don't own one, unless I go to a trucking company who says, hey, we'll hire you on the spot, we'll give you the training, and we'll pay you $90,000 a year to drive for us. I'm racking my brain on how this could work. So I think this is a wonderful bill. I think we need to explore this private-public partnership. We need to dig deep into this and get something like this to go. So I appreciate you bringing it forward, and thank you for coming today.
Thank you, Mr. Benner. You can, I don't know that there's going to be any other questions for you. To wrap it up, Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to throw the replay flag out here and go back to what Representative Olson said on the last bill, that the state workers are there and they should do the work and they can do the work. Yeah. So I'm trying to figure out which one it is. And I'm pretty sure that the AFSCME folks represent both of those workers that were in your office last week and the ones that would be affected by this. And so I think it, you know, for me, I think it's an inefficient waste of money or inefficient use of money when we're giving private entities, you know, skimming off the top of the taxpayers to give to private entities. And so I do agree with you, Representative Olson. I do think the state workers are good at their jobs and that they should be the ones doing this work and that they want to do it and that we should let them do it. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cagle. I'll stay out of the 50-yard line here. Representative Joy, any closing comments?
Just, you know, as people drive around, pay attention to the trains going around, because when you see trailers on trains, that means we're lacking drivers. And just because the rail runs up and down, east to west, there's still small rural Minnesota communities that get their delivery trucks. And some of us have had to sacrifice not getting twice-a-week deliveries. We've had to go to single deliveries because they don't have drivers. I just feel something like this will expand it and move it faster, and I think this is important legislation to move through. Thank you.
I appreciate the bill. We are laying it over, and I think it's an important topic. Things don't just show up on the stores without some mode of transportation to get there. So thank you for the bill. We'll take it under consideration, lay it over for possible inclusion. So House File 1242 is laid over. Next bill that we have before us is House File 1167, Representative Anderson. We do have a few testifiers. So Representative Anderson, we'll start with you to introduce the bill. And you can also move your amendment. And this bill will be going to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll start out. I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
Representative Anderson moves the A1 amendment to House File 1167. All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The author's amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm going to take a few minutes longer than I normally would to give some history on this. House File 1160. That's been like eight committees. House File 1167 directs the Commissioner of Transportation and MnDOT to cease spending funds for the study, planning, engineering, design, and construction of the proposed Northern Lights Express passenger rail train between the Twin Cities and Duluth. And as you know, in 2023, the legislature authorized $194.7 million in state funds as a set-aside for this project. MnDOT was directed to begin pursuing possible federal funds for its development, of which federal grants were expected to pay 80% of the project cost in order for it to be viable. In December of 23, the Federal Railroad Administration announced the project as being included in the newly created Corridor ID program as a potential candidate for federal grants and funding for expanded passenger rail service across the United States. And they granted $500,000 to start step one of the program to develop a scope and a cost estimate for the service. This funding was all part of the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act. Now, according to MnDOT, the Northern Lights Express is projected to have four round trips per day connecting Minneapolis and Duluth. Original 2011 MnDOT estimates place ridership at about 700,000 in the first year, and the train's expected to take about 2.5 hours, which, of course, is slower than at least I can drive to Duluth. In addition, at the 700,000 trip estimate, the state of Minnesota is expected to cover about $7 million each year in operating costs. So that's at the 700,000 estimate in riders. The current estimate for the cost of the project is almost $600 million, which, given our experience with other rail projects, is likely significantly below what would be the actual final cost. And again, this is just an estimate that was thrown out there originally. A few weeks ago, MnDOT released the Twin Cities St. Cloud Fargo-Moorhead Corridor study that we all saw. And in that study, the estimate annual ridership for passenger rails is similar between Minneapolis and Fargo was between 130,000 and 600,000. Now, that's a big range, big range. And as we've seen, the actual ridership on these trains has always been on the lower end of estimates or even below the lowest estimate. Now, the population of Fargo-Moorhead region is almost twice that of Duluth-Superior. And if the MnDOT updated potential passenger numbers between Minneapolis and Fargo are between 130,000 and 600,000, it's pretty impossible for the Minneapolis to Duluth numbers to be 700,000, that number that was estimated from data from 2011. So as the Northern Lights Express operating subsidy is based on the 700,000 estimate, we can really surmise that the permanent operating cost would be significantly higher than the original estimates that we've been given, because that's been consistent with every single train project that we've seen here in Minnesota. So I'd like to also just briefly touch on the realities of both our state and federal budget situations. You know, while the FRA grant program was instituted under the Biden administration at a time when we were spending really trillions of dollars on COVID-related programs and dramatically increasing federal spending in general, the fiscal reckoning has arrived. Securing an 80% federal funding match for this project is a requirement, and it needs to be granted in the next 3 years, according to the original legislation, or this project is going to be automatically mothballed and the dollars would go back to the general fund. Now, a week ago, Secretary Duffy signed an order that said all grant making must be done based on sound economic principles and a cost-benefit analysis where the benefits outweigh the costs. And to that end, I think the Federal Department of Transportation will be revising notices of funding opportunities and programs, and I highly suspect the FRA grant program will join others on the chopping block as the Fed's attempt to get their fiscal house in order. Here in Minnesota, we saw an $18 billion surplus spent or dollars set aside for projects as in this case. But now that we face a $6 billion deficit, we're going to be forced to make cuts in programs, both old programs and those newly created programs from the last legislative session. And I highly doubt that another $1 billion train project would be considered a wise use of resources in the fiscal environment that we currently face in Minnesota. So this bill is really a simple recognition of the reality that there are much better ways of moving people around than another train project that likely won't end up funded, frankly, by the feds anyway. We have significant maintenance needs. We had an earlier presentation, I think it was almost $1 billion, $900 million a year for the next 20 years that we're behind. Those are our maintenance needs. And we have to figure out how we're going to plug that gap. We need to be realistic, folks, and we need to face reality, and we need to take care of what we have. I also want to point out there's currently a shuttle service between the airport and Duluth. I saw their little van going, and I called, and it's at about $49 each way, and it runs about four times a day. And so for those folks that don't or can't, don't want to drive, there's other options. And finally, at some point soon, we all know we're going to have autonomous vehicles probably, maybe autonomous public, you know, buses too, public transportation. And that will use our current infrastructure. It will use our road infrastructure. So that's the way of the future, and a billion-dollar train is not. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. I think it is, members, if you've been on the committee for a while, we've had this discussion many times. So we are engaged in, again, I think you appropriately hit it, especially looking at the maintenance of our system, of how we're spending our dollars and making sure that we use it in the most efficient manner possible to upstand our infrastructure that we have to keep it maintained. And so that's why the bill is really before us. We will go to testifiers. We're going to start with our Zoom person, as long as we have the connection, make sure that we don't lose that. If you can hear us, please introduce yourself. Every testifier, we're going to keep to a strict 2 minutes. We've heard this bill many times, so hopefully you're not repeating the previous testifier. But we'll start with Cal Randa, if you're on Zoom, I believe.
Hello. Thank you, Chair and members
of
the committee.
Please introduce yourself and who you're with, and then proceed with your testimony.
Sure thing. My name's Cal Randa. I'm a resident of Duluth, Minnesota. I'm only testifying as a concerned member of the public.
Please proceed with your testimony.
Okay. So first, I'd like to apologize if my voice sounds weak or scratchy. I have norovirus and I'm homesick. But so today I am opposing Minnesota House File 1167 simply as a concerned citizen. Let me first reiterate that, this topic has already been heavily discussed and it was already approved in the 2023 House session. Any further debate on this topic seems superfluous, especially when that time and energy could be used towards making this project a reality. The benefits of the NLX are numerous, undeniable, and as I have said, have been heavily discussed. But to name just a few, it would make roads safer by reducing the number of cars on the I-35 corridor. But beyond safety, especially concerning the report from MDOT you all just heard, surely reducing the stress on our roadways with this project would therefore reduce the consistent need for maintenance due to the, less stress being on the roadway. Additionally, it would provide reliable transportation for those without access to a car, especially the thousands of students within our university system that are going both from Duluth to Minneapolis and vice versa. Finally, I do find it hard to argue against the idea of creating 3,000 well-paying jobs, especially in this economy. I personally find it complexing that some individuals continue to oppose this project. Interestingly, while I've seen numerous online comments expressing disconsent from the public, every person I've actually spoken to in real life in Duluth has shown excitement about this project. They look forward to enjoying weekends in the cities, or if they're in Minneapolis area, enjoying their time in Duluth without worrying about their car needing to make the trip or facing the dangers of driving in the snow. Thank you for your attention. That's all I had.
Thank you. Representative Jones, do you have a comment for this testifier or overall? Representative Jones, did you have a comment?
Joy.
Murphy.
Murphy, Joy, Jones.
We talk about 700, ridership is 700 a year, 700,000 a year.
Yeah, is this to the testifier?
Yeah, the testifier. How do we get that?
Mr. Randa, the question is about the 700,000 per year ridership.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a comment on that? How was that derived? Is that going to meet expectations?
Oh, I don't know how that number was derived. Like I said, I'm just a concerned member of the public. I'm sure the people either at MDOT that have, or with the Northern Lights Express committee, I forget their full name. I'm sure they were the reason.
Representative Anderson, do you have a response to Representative Joy?
Thank you, Chair Kosnick, Representative Joy. These are the numbers from MnDOT. When they were doing their estimates, the estimate was based on cell phone data from 2011, apparently. So that's what I could get from their report. That's what they said. So these are very preliminary. Same with the construction cost estimates, very, very preliminary. The reason I pointed out, I know you're from that general Fargo-Moorhead area. MnDOT's own study that came out a few weeks ago said that if we were going to do the passenger rail to Fargo, it would be way under that, and that metro area is twice the size of Duluth Superior. So I just can't imagine that we're going to have 700,000 people.
Representative Joy, do you have a follow-up? Right, otherwise, right. We'll go on with the other testifiers.
Thank you.
You're good? Okay, we'll start with Mr. Mueller. Welcome back to the committee. I think I know what you're going to say. We're glad you're here anyways. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony and keep it under 2 minutes.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Kosnick, members of the committee. I'm Joel Mueller with the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen. We respectfully oppose this bill. Recent data on ridership indicates the general public actually does favor intercity passenger rail alternative that is both reliable and efficient. In 2024, the number of passengers utilizing intercity passenger rail increased by 14% to reaching a record high. A prime example of this trend can be seen right here in Minnesota with the success of Amtrak's new Borealis service between the Twin Cities and Chicago, offering second daily service between those two cities. Borealis has surpassed initial ridership projections since its debut, carrying 100,000 passengers in its first 5 months of operation. Minnesota will not only reap the rewards of a dependable, efficient mode of transportation with NLX, but it will also experience the added advantage of job opportunities stemming from the project. Those jobs provide attractive compensation, perks, and job security. Skilled workers will be needed for the necessary improvements to the infrastructure, and railroad engineers, conductors, trainmen, maintenance workers will be needed to upkeep the equipment and the track, upgrading it and maintaining it at a higher standard than what it is right now. Another advantage that comes from this project is, if Minnesota decides to reject the NLX project, it will be placing the state at a competitive disadvantage economically. Other states are exploring passenger rail projects, and those projects have bipartisan support. So please oppose this bill, and I remain available for comments. Thank you. Questions?
I did have a quick question. You'd mentioned a 14% increase in ridership in 2024. Was that from pre-COVID levels or from just the previous year?
From the previous year. It's the record high across the nation.
So is the actual ridership higher than pre-COVID levels then or no?
Yes. Record high ever.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Next, we'll proceed with Mr. Keith Nelson. And then we'll have Annie Harala. Apologize. Is that close enough? if you want to just come up and sit next to him, then we'll continue on. Welcome, Mr. Nelson. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony. Introduce yourself, say who you're with, and proceed with your testimony, and you have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity. Something I don't normally do is read from a script, but in the interest of time, I want to make sure that I include everything that I wanted to testify on. My name is Keith Nelson. I'm a 7-term St. Louis County Commissioner, serving the people of Minnesota's Iron Range for that length of time. I'm also a 40-year small businessman in St. Louis County. I'm also a small beef farmer in St. Louis County. And how important is this to me? I'm here in the middle of calving season, folks. This one thing is going to transform a lot of issues that we have in northeastern Minnesota. So I'm here today as a St. Louis County Commissioner and as the chair of the NLX Alliance. On behalf of the NLX Alliance, we strongly oppose House File 1167 with very much respect, Representative, because it threatens to stall critical transportation investments and jeopardize Minnesota's ability to secure the federal funding for the Northern Lights Express passenger rail project. Unlike past rail projects in Minnesota, NLX is uniquely positioned for success. It is not a speculative or unfunded project. It is well-planned, federally supported initiative with significant momentum. MnDOT has already applied for funding through the Federal State Partnership for Intercity Passenger Rail Program, and the federal government is prioritizing passenger rail expansion like never before. If Minnesota fails to commit its state match, we risk losing hundreds of millions of dollars to other states like Florida, Texas, Montana, to other states that are already to act. The Northern Lights Express will provide a fast, reliable rail connection between the Twin Cities and Duluth using existing BNSF railway tracks. This means lower costs, fewer right-of-way challenges, and a quicker path to implementation compared to other rail projects that require entirely new infrastructure. This is a proven corridor with demonstrated ridership demand, and it will bring more than $1 billion in economic benefits to the region, supporting job creation, tourism, and business growth along the route. House File 1167 would undermine the opportunity by restricting the use of state funds that are essential to securing the federal dollars. With all respect, Mr. Chair, this is as fast as I can talk, and I've driven 2.5 to 3 hours to get here today.
No, please wrap it up. You do have another testifier from St. Louis County with you. So.
And I appreciate it very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Without those matching funds, the project simply cannot move forward. Rejecting House File 1167 is not just about supporting passenger rail. It's about ensuring that Minnesota does not forfeit a transformational investment in our state's infrastructure and economy. I urge this committee to oppose House File 1167 and allow Minnesota to move forward with the Northern Lights Express. This is a once-in-a-generation opportunity, and we cannot afford to let it pass us by. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members, and thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. The next testifier, Annie Harla.
Yes.
Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Annie Harla. I am the chair commissioner of St. Louis County Board. And it's not often you see a member of Northern St. Louis County and Southern St. Louis County really advocating for something in Duluth. And that is a connection from Duluth and the range. This is a unique opportunity to work alongside my colleague. I appreciated, as I sat here earlier, that you were talking about process with funding roads. This bill, I'm respectfully opposing the bill. This bill is removing a process from what is happening at the federal level. This is premature within the setting. We don't have a crystal ball for what's happening in Washington, and you are working really hard here at the state to make sure that our systems and response keep us strong. And so we have an incredibly unique opportunity to leverage this match at a federal level. And you've heard a lot of colleagues talk about how this is going to make sure that people make it here, make sure that we have veterans that get down and get the health care that they need, that we've got college students coming through. But it also significantly makes a big investment in a bridge at the port. And I'm a commissioner from Duluth. The port is right in my district, and a $1 billion port needs a strong bridge to go through so we can see goods going back and forth. And while I know with the trucking person earlier that they were speaking about the need for when you see something on a train, we need all different types of transportation to get our goods across the country. This is a way to move people on an existing rail line. We have the money that is set, and we ask that you continue to let the federal process take place so that we can get the match at that level. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak today, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
Thank you. Representative Olson, are you holding your comments until later, or do you have them now? And then we've got Representative Jones and Kraft, I presume the same, or did you have comments now? Great. We will move to Darwin Schifferlin. And then we have Colin Jones, followed by Ann Lynch. Oh, just available. Okay.
I do believe Darwin is not here today.
Okay. Colin Jones. Welcome to the committee. I'm sure you've heard us previously. Just identify your name and who you're with, and then proceed with your testimony, and you have 2 minutes.
Okay. My name is Colin Jones. I'm from Duluth. I'm studying as a transportation engineer at UMD. And I'm here to testify today against Bill 1167. I moved out to Duluth for college and come back to see my family every time that there's a break. We live in the Twin Cities. I just recently, on Friday, took a bus home that was packed. Every single bus that I've ever taken between Duluth and the Twin Cities is always full. This one was oversold. And this, I mean, the traffic benefits have already been spoken about briefly. I don't think I need to go over that. 40% of UMD students are from the Twin Cities. We take this bus constantly, and it is not enough. And a $49 shuttle is furthermore far too expensive because the ticket price for NLX is $30 to $35, at least as we saw on earlier estimates that MnDOT has put out. The notion that nobody will ride passenger trains is demonstrably false because, I mean, at Union Depot, there is a new train service which MnDOT estimated would have 125,000 riders in the first year. It has been 8 months, and that number is 163,000. And I've taken that train 5 times. Every time that I've taken it, it is packed. The average, like, every seat is sold out consistently. And if you crunch the numbers on that, the actual ridership comes out as this was twice as high as was expected for 8 months in to the service. And furthermore, it has complete recovery of fare box subsidy. So, and like with the riders on the Borealis, just the same as will be on NLX, they're like these people bring along hundreds of millions of dollars in economic growth. I mean, I know I spent money at Red Wing, or correction, at Winona, every time that I've taken it. I spent money at La Crosse. And I firmly believe that the Twin Cities, which has gotten this service, is not the only one who deserves great transportation. Greater Minnesota deserves it as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Representative Anderson, you know, there's been talk about the Borealis line of 163,000 passengers a day. This train, commuter rail, or excuse me, per year, 700,000 per year. That's a big difference. Is even 700,000, is that a break-even point? Are you aware?
Chair Kosnick, the 600,000 is the numbers from here to Chicago. Chicago is a much bigger city. And the numbers in here, it was in MnDOT estimates, are 700,000. And no, even at 700,000, there we lose, I think it, I do have the numbers actually, I think it's close to $10 million is the operating subsidy for, I have it actually exactly, let me see if I can.
Well, we can look it up later. I thought maybe if you knew offhand.
But no, it's not. And it's I think it's close to $10 million a year at 700,000 trips. So to between here and Duluth.
Yeah. And when I was doing the North Star, we were looking for about 800,000 per year, 400 or 900, 450 in a 6 month period on the one bill, just to meet those projections, and never did. And so I'm concerned that spending another $200 million plus the other cost associated with it, we can do better with and use those dollars more efficiently to get people where they need to go, if that is in Duluth. I know I was talking to a Representative Scraba earlier and the canoe country discussion that we had. You can get a train to Duluth, but it still doesn't get you to canoe country. And if you're going to canoe country, you need a way to haul your cargo. So that is the concern. We had Ann Lynch here, just available to testify, but I don't. submitted a letter. Okay. So, members, if you did have questions for MnDOT, we do have somebody available to that. Representative, that concludes our testimony. Is there any other public testimony? Well, there is one person. Okay. Anybody else? When you're done with your testimony, the page will ask. Go ahead. The page will ask for your name for the public record. But welcome to the committee. State your name, and then you start with your testimony and let us know who you're with. Or,
all right. Hello, everybody. My name is Rox Everingham. That's R-O-X. It's short for Roxy, pretty much. I come speaking to you today. I'm not really with anybody, but I come as just a resident of Minneapolis, just up the road, and a person that frequently uses the transit systems here, both through, like, commuter rail services, light rail, buses, that kind of stuff. And it's my first time doing this. I'm a little bit nervous, so I'll try to make this quick. Many of the people that have come to testimony today have knocked through a couple of points, many of which that I've written on my hastily made paper that I've written over the weekend. But I have a few things, actually, that I added in during the discussion that was have. So I think that I'm testifying against House File 1167 because I feel that the bill is just very short-sighted and really doesn't consider the general opinion and of what Minnesotans are desiring when it comes to seeking for alternative transportation to go from the Twin Cities up to Duluth, as well as the smaller communities that are connecting via Northern Lights Express, that, of course, being Coon Rapids, Cambridge, Hinckley, and Superior, Wisconsin. I feel that to also mention on the Borealis' success, having 100,000 riders within the first, like, 8 months of its service is very much a positive look for the benefits that we can receive in both an economic and quality of life improvement for the people going to and fro both Chicago and, like, many places along the way. I just feel that, personally, if we're trying to work towards a more sustainable future, a more safer place for our people to get from point A to point B, it should not be just expanding the highways or just, like, having them take a bus or a small shuttle service from the airport through those kinds of places. And I especially don't really feel confident in having to rely on traveling from point A to point B in the future with autonomous pods because, well, you can't even get a reliable Google search these days, so I don't see why I should be relying on some robot driving the car. But that's just my opinion. So the other benefits that we can receive from these services, there's less wear and tear in our highways. There's going to be a lot more economic development for the downtowns of these places, both Duluth and Minneapolis. And I also feel that this can just make it a lot safer for people trying to get to those places as well, whether they are going there for leisure, for business, or to just see their families again, for whatever the occasion may be. And we've even seen this week, earlier this week, the benefits of having these services available for our people because of their reliability. When roads were closed or covered with snow, when buses such as the Jefferson Lines, Greyhound, and even those other little shuttle services were shut off because of the snow, the North Star, Borealis, and the light rail were still going through. And so I just feel that by investing more into these, we're investing more into people. We are investing more in jobs. We are investing more in trying to make life better for our people. So that's my testimony, and I hope this will consider your decision making.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. The page will probably want you to sign in. Any other public testimony? I don't believe there is any. Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Anderson. I understand that the committee has heard this topic several times, but I'm new, so I'm excited to get to talk about trains. Mm-hmm. There was a statement made that the train wouldn't pay for itself. And we also had a presentation earlier about our road funding, and so I'm wondering, do roads pay for themselves?
Representative Jones, are you asking the author or?
Yes.
MnDOT or? Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Representative Jones, gas taxes, tab fees, all those things are essentially the way we do user fees to build roads. And we're trying to, and I support user fees for things. So the person that uses it should pay for it. And so That's essentially how that's treated. So the subsidy on, I mean, that gets into a whole ball of worms, right, Representative Kraft? the question about the subsidy on transit versus, you know, the extra taxes that go into roads. So beyond the user fees, which are directly tab fees and gas fees.
Mm-hmm. Follow-up, Representative Jones?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Anderson. So I agree that in Minnesota, we got this nice chart this today, and, you know, there is 10% that doesn't come from user fees. And also on this chart, it didn't show the billions of dollars that we have gotten from the federal government over the last 80 years for our roads. So the federal government, if nothing else, has been subsidizing our roads. And so I just want to set aside the argument that transportation modes pay for themselves, because they don't. Mm-hmm. And so we shouldn't set that expectation for rail itself, because we really want, what we should be doing is serving Minnesotans. I believe Representative Joy, you said really well earlier that, you know, we want to make sure that we're serving Minnesotans. And what I heard from testifiers and what I've seen from the lot of letters that we've gotten, it looks like this line would serve veterans, cities in greater Minnesota, St. Louis County, City of Cambridge, workers, people with disabilities, seniors. I also want to highlight that one person clearly said in bold letters, I want my tax dollars to fund this project. Having other means of transportation is important in our state. Shuttle service was mentioned as one of those options. I agree it is an option. That's great for folks coming from Duluth to come to MSP. But if I'm wanting to go to Duluth, do I need to go to the airport first? That doesn't make a lot of sense. Our transit networks are focused on downtowns, and so it makes sense to, with a train, that we go to downtown and take it from there. Because I am someone who does rely on transit and on trains. And also my predecessor did too. And all those people that I mentioned before, one out of three Minnesotans cannot drive for one reason or another: age, accessibility, affordability. And so when there are bills like this, when we have projects that have been worked on by community members, by MnDOT, we've invested in this. It's not great. It's not great. I also want to say that you had brought up the federal government, that they're getting their fiscal house in order as kind of a piece of good governance. What I really don't understand, though, is how cutting services to everyday Americans in order to create tax cuts to billionaires is good governance. Like, let's be clear about this. We are trying to cut services here to this train because we want to make up for it so we can pay for our roads, because we know that more cuts are coming because they want to give tax cuts to billionaires.
If so, we can stick to the bill, please.
What I'm interested in, and what I think all of us are interested in, is the well-being of Minnesotans. And that means investing in them and having good governance. And like another testifier said, we need transformational investments in order to grow greater Minnesota, in order to grow the metro. And projects like this are what we need. Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Just a couple things. Let me talk about the 100,000 quick. So 100,000 people are taking the train down to, or more than that. So let's say it's 200,000 taking the train down to Chicago. That's great. So that the economics on this project were based on 700,000. Okay. So this is more, everything that we've seen with other projects, including MnDOT's own numbers on their estimates going to Fargo. This is probably about one-tenth of that, which would dramatically increase. I found the number at 7 million based on 700,000 trips. It's probably 10 times that. That would be the subsidy, which is something that would be a cost that this legislature would have to fund down the road and would be competing with other things that we want to spend, you know, dollars on. So it's what I'm attempting to do here is to just help as we're going to be making decisions, because we don't have a $17, $18 billion surplus to just throw $200 million here and $200 million there and spend this, what happened 2 years ago. We don't have that anymore. So we have to make very real budget decisions about what we're going to fund now and for the future. This project comes with significant operating costs. It also comes with the big question of, will it be funded anyway by the feds, who have a $36 trillion debt? We are spending more money on interest on the debt, federal debt, than we do on defense. It's crazy. And we are bankrupting this company, this country. So they have to do something. And we have to do something, because we have a $6 billion hole facing us in the next couple of years. So this is an option. This is an option, and as we sit here as a committee, we need to make decisions. Where are our transportation dollars best used? Is it used to maintain our existing infrastructure, or is it used to build another train that we know is going to be way more than some estimates from 15 years ago would cost? So thank you.
Okay. We have a couple members, and Representative Jones, if we have time, we'll go back to you, but we gave you some lengthy time. Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll start off with some comments and maybe get to a question. I just want to make it clear that Chicago has 9.4 million people. Minneapolis-St. Paul has 3.7 million people. Those numbers are always going to be higher just by the sheer number. The Fargo-Moorhead has about 270,000 people. Duluth-Superior has about 645,000. So I was surprised to see that. I've done it like five times. I have no idea how Duluth-Superior. Google it. It blew me away. Because when I was doing Duluth, I was getting 262,000. And then when I put Duluth-Superior, I got 645,000. And I'm like, did I get something wrong? So...
Hey, we're going to speak through the chair. Let Representative Scraba make his comments. Yeah. We will speak through the chair members.
Let me go back. And so those numbers to Chicago and that, they're going to be higher. They have to be higher. You have more people. That's just the way it is. If you want to compare the two, then put them down in a percentage. To Representative Jones, this afternoon's started with the gap, the funding of the gap. The gap just keeps growing between transportation and the amount of money we have. To invest in another form of transportation that we know doesn't pay for itself, because that's what transportation doesn't pay for itself, we're just putting ourselves in the hole even more. I'm trying to be as pragmatic as I can here, but it's just like, okay, we know we're going to lose money on this. How much money do we want to lose? Because we're not going to make money. So I have the testifier said it costs between $30 and $35 for a ticket for NLX. That was the estimate. What year and when was that? And MnDOT can help me on that. I'm curious what the new number is, because I sat in meetings this morning about inflation, and it's numbing. It's just numbing what's happening to all the numbers. So if that number was prior to our big inflation hit, how much would that ticket be?
Okay, and, Representative Scraba, we got about 10 minutes.
That's all I've got way more, but that's fine. Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do you have
Chair.
A quick answer on the...
I do. Thank you, Ms. Chair. What's on their website. So I don't think it's based on anything except guessing operating numbers at 700,000 person trips per year.
Okay.
So that's it.
Representative Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Jones, I really appreciate your enthusiasm. I wish that when you say one-third of Minnesotans don't drive, you also put an asterisk in there that said most of them can't ride transit without an adult either, because Metro Transit requires you to be 12 years or older to ride by yourself. So good is a good stat. Sounds good. If we come back with a number that says how many people who could otherwise ride Metro Transit, that would help me personally. You've mentioned it a couple of times, and this is me being very sincere with you on that. And so that's an issue for me. When we're talking about Representative Scraba, yeah, you, there was a mistake in your comment. I did the math, too, and you kind of stole some of my thunder. Chicago has 9.26 million in their metro area, 3.7 in Minneapolis-St. Paul area. Duluth has 86,680 people, and Superior has 26,571 for a grand total of 113,431 people in those two locations. So the concept that we can equate in 8 months 163,000 people riding from Minneapolis, St. Paul area to Chicago in 8 months, and we're going to come up with 700,000 people going to Duluth and back, I think that's inconceivable. I think that anyone who understands basic math would argue that there is no way. If you can go between a place with 9 and a place with 3.7, so you can run between 14 million people and you get 163,000 trips, there's no way you can go from 3.7 to 113,000 and make 700,000. Anyone making that argument, they need to reevaluate their numbers. But here's the biggest problem with this project. We don't know the actual cost of this project. We don't know its feasibility. We have absolutely no idea. 2 years ago, we threw $200 million at this project, said, make it work, make it happen. And we don't have anything other than that. The requirements for the service, the requirements for the upgrades to the line, whatever it's is necessary to make this happen, it is an imagination. Like, we have no real idea. Ah, it's 200,000. Not to mention the fact that building a passenger train, it ridiculously disrupts freight. The freight trains have to pull off to the side to wait for the passenger train to go because no one wants two trains hitting each other. So the question is, the biggest driver of our economy, you want to talk about rail, want to talk about freight going on rail, you want to talk about carbon emission reduction by taking a freight train and filling it with millions and millions of pounds worth of grain or oil or fuel or whatever, the list goes on and on and on, and telling that train that it has to pull over because there are three people trying to get to Duluth and they need to ride it. That's ridiculous. That is absolutely ridiculous. It is irresponsible, and this project is taking $200 million state dollars and a significant portion of federal dollars and just throwing it in a hole and lighting the match. We are throwing it away. This could be so much more responsibly spent. I mean, you could almost go to you want to talk about trains, find a different train to advocate for, because this one doesn't make any sense.
Okay, members, we have about 5 minutes. Representative Tabke, Representative Kraft, and then Representative Cagle wanted to close, I believe, and then we'll give you the last word, and then we're moving it to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be very quick with this. I just want to Representative Scraba was talking about, and Representative Olson were talking about the differences in size of Duluth to Chicago. But the thing, to put a plug in for intercity rail and why this is a really important thing for the future of Minnesota is that there are how many flights that go between Minneapolis and Chicago every single day. And there are a lot of different options for how you can get from our metro to Chicago. And so this would add more benefit to Duluth. And there are obviously flights that go back and forth between Duluth and Minneapolis, but not nearly as many as there are to Chicago. And so there are significant options available to Chicago. And then we also haven't talked at all about carbon emissions, greenhouse gas emissions. Trains are significantly 95% fewer emissions than flights have. And so what this does is it helps to keep the waters and the air clean all throughout Minnesota and where we want to be traveling back and forth, because I want to take a train to Duluth. I think that is a really, really good way for my family and I to get back and forth, and I think it's a really important thing that we do not discount the importance in our state of intercity rail, passenger rail. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tabke. Representative Kraft, we've got about 3 minutes.
Thank you.
We've got Representative Cagle, too. You got about 2 minutes.
All right. I'd like to request a roll call on this.
I would love a roll call.
Mr. Chair, so a few things. A lot of numbers have been thrown out here. The Fargo-Moorhead metro area, if you then look at the Duluth metro area, they're about the same size. Yes, we can talk about that. And the Chicago train, the other piece is it's an 8-hour train ride there. We're talking about 2.5 hours to Duluth. I mean, the drawing a comparison, and by the way, that was one line that achieved 100,000 ridership in 5 months. There's another line. So I think you're trying to draw parallels just make no sense. You also mentioned there are better ways to get people around. We heard a testifier speak about how the trains were still running during snow events when other things were not. And did you know that you are 17 times more likely to die in a car than you are in a train? So I think the folks that if we put more people in trains and we see a reduction in people dying on our roads, maybe that might be a slightly better way of getting around. And you also made comments about actual ridership on these trains has been on the lower end of the range. It's just not true. I don't know which trains you're talking about. Certainly there are some, and there are many that have shown exceeding. And then the last thing I had to say, your argument of, look, the feds aren't going to do it, so we shouldn't. Well, if the feds don't do it, it would mean an illegal impoundment of committed funds as part of the Bipartisan Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. And we must push back, and we should all be pushing back against illegal executive orders. You wouldn't want the governor to do it here, and you shouldn't want the president to do it federally. So those funds there, we should be compete for them, and we should get it, and we should go forward with this. Thank you.
Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Anderson, do you have any testifiers in support of this legislation?
Representative Cagle, I did not ask anyone to testify.
I don't know that that's pertinent, Representative Cagle.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it is pertinent because there's 28 different letters opposing this in the in our packets. They're letters submitted from unions, trade organizations, veterans organizations, Chamber of Commerce, the committee, and the counties. Also, Representative Anderson, do you know where this is in the federal grant process, this project?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you. This is, what's it called? They're doing a step one right now. So there was a grant given to a whole bunch of these rail projects last fall or last summer. Last
Representative
fall,
Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Mm-hmm. Chair. Well, right now we're in the middle of waiting for the grant application to be approved for the continuation of the project. Mm-hmm. They've asked for all the funding. And then also some other, if we were able to do it in phases as well. And we will find out in April if we were awarded that funding. So I think this is really premature. Also, you know, this is going to do a lot of upgrades to the freight rail on there. And I totally disagree with, I can't remember if it was Representative Murphy who said, you know, when you see those cars, it's because they don't have truck drivers. I don't know. I think maybe it's because it's a good, better, more efficient way to get goods and services to places. So I also heard that nobody's going to use this train. Well, I don't know how many families have planned a summer weekend trip to Fargo, but I know a lot of us have planned summer weekend trips to Duluth. And I also just want to say that, you know, Senator Dibble and I met with the FRA commissioner, the outgoing FRA commissioner earlier this year, and he had conversations with FRA of the ingoing administration, and he was very positive about the chance for this project to get funded. And so, you know, we have our commissioner, or the new transportation czar for the Trump administration is Sean Duffy, who happens to be from northern Wisconsin and represented Superior. Also, if you look at the birth rates along the line, it's actually goes right in line with the Commissioner Duffy's, you know, want to put funding near where births are. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think this project has a really good chance of getting funded. And then we're going to be able to get people up to the 49ers facility in Hinckley to do training. We're going to be able to get students to school. I went to UMD, undergrad and grad. I had to commute down to the cities on the weekends for work and stuff. So this would have been really helpful for me. My dad lives in Two Harbors. He's getting a little older. I don't know if I want him driving too much. You know, he could hop on this train and be just a few steps away from my door when he gets off of it. And so I think this is really premature. The fact that we had 28 letters in opposition to this bill and not a single testifier here in support of it, I think is very telling. And so I would just like to recommend to my members a no vote, and also any of the members who might care about folks getting to the North Shore. Thank you.
Representative Anderson, do you have any quick closing comments, and then we're going to a vote? Roll call has been requested.
We are, yeah, out of time. I just want to, again, thank the committee, and just, again, we're out of money.
Okay, we're going to go to the roll call vote there. Let's proceed with the roll call vote. Just, we're out of time, and they need the room.
Chair Kosnick?
Yes.
Vice Chair Myers?
Yes.
And Rep. Anderson?
Yes.
Representative Berg?
No.
Representative Fogelman?
Yes.
Representative Green?
No.
Representative Jones?
No.
Representative Joy?
Yes.
Representative Kraft?
No.
Representative Murphy?
Yes.
Representative Olson?
Yes.
Representative Ream?
No.
Representative Sensomura?
No.
Representative Scraba?
Yes.
Representative Tabke?
No.
The motion was for House File 1242.
Nope.
Nope. 1167 to be referred to the Ways and Means. There's been, as amended, 8 ayes, 7 nays. The motion prevails, and we are on the ways to Ways and Means. Members, I appreciate the discussion today. Obviously, difference of opinions. And with that, we will adjourn the meeting, and we'll see you Wednesday.